call to order. House Committee on Land Use for Thursday, April 16th, 2009. Colleagues, we've had some developments with a couple of the bills that are scheduled for today's meeting. That means other people are going to do the work instead of the committee, which is usually a good thing. And I think in this case, it is definitely a good thing. The Department of State Lands and the interested parties, including the sponsor on House Bill 2573, are still working toward a resolution that may obviate the need for that bill. So I think technically I have to open that work session in order to carry it over. No. We'll just carry that bill over for work session to our next meeting next Tuesday. House Bill 2573. We'll carry over that work session until Tuesday because good productive work is being done and we don't want to get in the way of it. Similarly, colleagues, on House Bill 3226, the director of the Department of Agriculture has been working with the initiator of that bill and the affected property owners, and we believe that they can resolve the issue, protect the vineyard that is affected by the neighboring property without the need for legislation, and I think that that is a good way to approach that. So we are going to remove that. Well, we're not going to open that work session, and we're not even carrying that one over. It is possible in the next week that it might come back, but I don't expect so because the director of the department has taken a good leadership role in that, and I think we'll be able to resolve the problem. So House Bill 3226, not going to open that work session either. We are, however, going to now go to House Bill 2879. Are we opening a public hearing on this? Oh, Senator Starr probably didn't think we were going to get done quite as quickly as... Senator Starr wanted to testify on that bill, so that's the bill we will go to next. We'll stand at ease until we're ready to move on that bill.
I was on such a roll.
I can't clear the entire docket.
I thought you were doing very well, Madam Chair.
Let's stand at ease. hearing. Senator, have you caught your breath?
Of course. Would you like me to go forward?
Yes, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2879. We wanted to accommodate your schedule. Can we get a brief reminder from the Ms. Ross on the bill? Since we heard it before.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, the previous hearing was on March 19th. The measure makes immune from liability landowners that allow access across their lands for people to reach adjacent properties for the purpose of recreation, wood cutting, or harvest of special wood products. Provides signage and notice requirements to prohibit specific activities, allows landowners to receive up to $1,000 in liquidated damages from persons who remain and engage in the prohibited activity. There have been amendments, however, that create immunity for landowners, allowing access, and then restore the original language. Those are the dash ones. The dash threes incorporate the dash ones, but narrow the applicability of immunity to only those landowners who do not improve their property to allow access. And I believe the senator appears on dash two amendments that were received today.
Okay. Colleagues, this is a bill that was brought to us by special districts. Mm-hmm. And we had some concerns about the original language and what it did in terms of liability issues, what incentives it did or didn't inadvertently or directly create. And so we'll have some further testimony from representatives of special districts and others who would like to testify, but I wanted to give the senator a chance to testify about a different amendment.
Madam Chair, which dash?
I'm here on the dash twos.
Dash twos, which I think should be in your stack.
Would you like me to?
Yes, please, Senator.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Senator Bristar. I have the great privilege of representing the fine citizens that live in Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, and North Plains in Washington County. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify on the Dash 2 amendments, Madam Chair, members of the committee. What you have in House Bill 2879 is a very great relating clause. So that's that's why I'm here, and my staff has worked with all the interested parties as it relates to this bill, and believe that there's no opposition to the Dash 2 amendments. And I'll just draw your attention to the front page of the Oregonian today. I didn't coordinate this, but right here it talks about the economy plants seeds of change, and it's a story about how folks are turning to growing their own food. Creating gardens where in the past they haven't done so. The Dash 2 amendments came to us, quite honestly, when I was in a town hall meeting just a few weeks ago, and a constituent said, why don't you as state legislators pass a law to make it easier for the citizens to grow their own food, to do community gardens, or to, we need to become more self-sufficient as citizens. And I thought, well, that sounds like an interesting idea, and how would we go about doing that? The Dash 2s are a very, very small step in that direction, and basically it just adds a couple of words to existing statute, and it provides immunity to property owners who make their land available for the public, for public use. It adds the words for gardening. So the idea is, if you're a property owner that owns a vacant lot, say in the city of Portland or in Hillsborough, that you could make your land available to the community for a community garden, and be immune from kind of the lawsuits potential that might arise for the public use of your land. Again, it's a small step toward this idea of folks banding together to grow, their own vegetables. It came to us from a constituent, and this particular idea in that same town hall, I had a former state legislator that was there. He said, "Well, why didn't you think about doing X?" And this is exactly what he suggested that we contemplate doing. So, with that, I think it's timely as we look at our economic situation that a number of our constituents are in. I know that in my own personal life, my wife has purchased a greenhouse and is got seeds in the ground in that greenhouse and is excited about growing more vegetables. I have a brother-in-law that has he lives a little bit more in a rural situation, rural circumstance. He doesn't live really in the country, in my opinion, but he lives in a kind of more of a rural suburban area, and they've purchased a dozen chicks. They're going to grow, obviously, chickens for eggs. I think that you're looking at a situation in our economy today where citizens are looking for opportunities to become more self-sufficient, and I think this is a simple idea, a simple way to do it. It fits in with existing statute, existing state law. I think it's appropriate for us to take this step. And Madam Chair, I appreciate the willingness to allow me to come in and testify on the Dash 2s. My staff, Laura Jansen, is here, and who is really has spent most of the time working with all the interested parties as it relates to the overriding issues in this bill. So she might be available to answer any particular questions as I need to run to committee here. So with that, if there's a question, I'd be happy to try to answer.
Just quickly, Senator, the original bill is about transition across a property to pursue a recreational activity. Your amendment, and I'm sorry, we are still getting them for members of the committee, so we may want to quiz your assistant instead. But your amendment is for a destination purpose, right? To the property to garden.
Yes, to you. Yeah, exactly. And it's basically we're adding for gardening or gardening into the statute in multiple places.
Okay. Any other questions for the senator? Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Pretty hard.
None of you had the copy.
You have the softball part of it.
Yeah. I apologize.
Okay. I would like actually to bring Mark Landauer forward since he's been working on an amendment to address some issues around concerns on liability.
Good afternoon. Thanks. Chair Nolan, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I'm here to speak on the Dash 3s. As you will recall, on March 19th, when this bill was before you, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association raised some concerns with the bill. Since that time, I have been in discussions with the Trial Lawyers Association, and the Dash 3s are a product of those discussions. There are two changes, significant changes, that the Dash 3s embody that I believe make everybody, at least, if not neutral, happy with the bill. The first can be found on lines 2 and 3, and the language there is, while being used by a person to reach land for a recreational purpose, the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association is concerned that the immunity would be granted for somebody who's crossing land in order to go to 7-Eleven. Well, this language clarifies that we are trying to cross the land or providing the immunity to individuals who are crossing land for specifically recreational purposes. The second issue that was of concern to the trial lawyers can be found on lines 6 through 9. They were concerned that landowners who have improved facilities on their land for the purposes of gaining access to adjacent recreational lands, the property owners would be given immunity if there were defects or hazards with those improvements. This language attempts to address that problem by ensuring that any improvements that have been made for the access to adjacent lands be maintained. And with that, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to try to address them.
I'd like to understand that language around improvements a little more.
Yes.
You're referring to the Dash 3 amendment,
yes,
there, line 6 there.
Yes.
So if the, as it says there, the path, trail, water, road, waterway, and other rights of way that have not been improved. So that have not been improved.
That's correct.
Modifies the the
immunity.
The path, the trail.
That's correct.
So if I haven't improved the
Path, trail, or
path on my property, and I allow people to use it, then I enjoy the immunity.
That is correct.
But if I remove an obstacle from that pathway, which makes it safer for people to use it, then I don't enjoy the immunity.
And
so I'm discouraged from making it safer.
No, what we are trying to do is encourage it to be safer.
Okay.
We are trying to make sure that the immunity only applies if you are maintaining those improved facilities. Okay? That is the intent of this language. Again, if somebody has, for example, put up a hand railing along a steep slope, we want to ensure that that handrail is maintained and not inadvertently give a landowner immunity for not maintaining what would be considered an important safety device.
I think what the chair is pointing out, though, is that as I read this language, I think it's consistent with common law anyway, but I think what this is saying is how she explained it. If you are merely letting people cross your property, you enjoy the immunity.
That is correct.
But if you have gone to some effort to encourage them to do it, then you don't enjoy the immunity. Isn't that right?
You are encouraging individuals to go across your property, if I'm following you correctly, and you have created facilities, a pathway, a little bridge, a railing, whatnot. What we are trying to ensure is that the landowner maintains those for that purpose. The issue that we were trying to deal with were irrigation maintenance roads. You will recall from our testimony that those roads were designed for maintenance of irrigation canals, not for recreational purposes or trails. Okay? But those maintenance roads are used as pathways to adjacent recreational facilities. And therein is the reasoning for this language, is because those maintenance roads were not specifically designed for actual access to recreational facilities.
I understand. This is going to sound counterintuitive to members of the committee, I think, but it's actually consistent with the common law about trespasser liability. And Representative Wingard had questions about this last time we heard this bill. The public policy behind a rule like this is to say, if you're a landowner and you are taking steps to affirmatively encourage people to use your land, then you can't be negligent in doing it, and therefore you're not going to be immune. If you're just being passive about it and allowing people to access your land to get somewhere else, then you will be immune. It may sound strange, but that's actually how the common law is developed. And I think this amendment is consistent with that.
Representative Cowan. Yeah, because I'm still processing this.
I'm trying to process this, too, and I don't have that legal mind to do it. But I understand the purpose of the legislation. I'm just trying to make sure that we don't go a different direction. So in light of the common law that we just heard about, and I think this is consistent, on my neck of the woods, one might have property that people would like to cross and climb down the cliff to get to the beach. So if you encourage that and you go out and build a stairway to get down to the beach, mm-hmm. and someone falls down that stairway, you could theoretically be held liable because you've made that possible. Whereas if they simply cross your property and fall off the rocks climbing down, you're not responsible because you didn't encourage them to do that by building the stairway.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, sadly, that actually makes sense to me.
He didn't have a legal mind out.
Well, she's ahead of me because I'm still struggling with the concept that if I do something to partially mitigate a hazard, I'm potentially liable for not fully mitigating it and not continuously mitigating it, which means I'm discouraged from doing anything. But I'm not going to take on common law here. I'll tell you that. Representative Wingard.
Madam Chair, I want to understand the permission standpoint of it. Are we making a distinction between somebody who has a piece of land and people are accessing it and them being okay with that? And what I'm wondering is have they done anything or do they have to do anything to make it clear that they're okay with people crossing their land or put up? I mean, how are we distinguishing between somebody who cuts across property to get to the beach, who the owner's okay with doing that, and who isn't? I mean, I may own a piece of property and build a stair for me and my family to use to get to the beach, and if other people are simply using it, how are we distinguishing that from me having done that on purpose for other people to use? I'm still confused about that.
It's a fair question, and I don't really know how to answer it because there are so many different circumstances under which people use land to gain access. We have the irrigation districts who have literally hundreds of miles of maintenance roads that are commonly being used as pathways for individuals to recreate or gain access to adjacent lands for recreational purposes. There are certainly...
Let me stop it, Madam Chair,
if you don't mind.
I'll follow, because I'm...
So let's take your example, then. Does the irrigation district know that people are doing this, and are they okay with it, or would they prefer people not do it? I mean, I guess I'm wondering what their state of mind is on this, and if I assume that matters.
Right. As you'll recall from the...
They didn't build these roads for people to do that. They're just doing their thing.
As you'll recall from our testimony on March 9th, there was a Supreme Court ruling, ODOT versus, and I'm sorry that I've forgotten the name, but I'll be happy to provide that again to the committee, that it made it very clear that adjacent landowners were now liable for any injuries that occurred. As a result of that ruling, irrigation districts who have these maintenance roads would be compelled, or it would be very much in their interest, to post no trespassing on all of their lands. But as a result of the Central Oregon Irrigation District's agreement with the Bend Park and Recs, as well as the Redmond Parks and Recs, who are using these maintenance roads for access and a very comprehensive trail system, they would prefer not to. As a result, here is the bill before you in hopes that we can extend this immunity to adjacent landowners in order to allow this type of behavior to continue, or this access to continue, if you will.
I guess I'm still just don't, and this may be common law, perhaps it goes back hundreds of years, but I am confused and bewildered by the idea that people can come onto someone else's property for egress, to try to get somewhere, and they are injured in some way or another, and unless the property owner did something like set cougars, traps out to purposely injure them, I don't understand why they should ever be liable for somebody falling down their staircase or the railing giving way or what have you. I mean, I suppose if you run into something for profit, and you have a cliff and you have a path you build and people are accessing boats you're renting to them or whatever, and so, I mean, then yes, obviously you're liable, but it seems to me if I build a rail on a path that my family and I use and other people use it, and I'm now required to meet ADA standards and make sure that railing conforms to all, because otherwise I can get this pantsuit off me because somebody, that just amazes me.
Go ahead. If I might.
Yep.
Because maybe I'm slowly coming around to understanding this. In the instance that Representative Cowan talked about, just a rocky bank, if the property owner allows me to go across it to access the beach. I don't expect the rocky beach to be safe. Or I am on alert that I have to be careful to cross it and understand that it could be unsteady or shifty or something like that. So if it gives way under my weight, I either knew or should have known, kind of standard, to exercise more caution. But if there's a railing there or a staircase, that maybe I should have some more expectation that it is safe. And that if it then fails under my weight, then at least we can argue over whether I had a reasonable expectation that it was there for a for a reason. So I'm kind of coming around to this.
Except that your point is still valid, though, that under that, as much as that makes sense to some degree, it creates a disincentive for people to provide any of that.
Well, or it says if you're going to improve it, you have to maintain your improvement.
Don't do it negligently.
Don't
create a hazard.
Representative Esquivel had a question, and then we'll go to Representative Cowan.
This is not a question. I think what we're struggling with is that, and what you were at first, Madam Chair, was if I try to do what's right to help people, I may end up in a lawsuit.
And don't allow access to your land. You have an answer there as a property owner.
It's not unlike the Good Samaritan laws that have been passed in some states because people have been sued for coming to the aid of people who are in distress.
And then pull them out of a burning car, you get sued because you didn't do it right.
We want to make sure people have an incentive to help, and so we've passed these kinds of immunities. It's somewhat of a similar principle here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. But on the other hand, when it comes to sportsmen accessing property, you're not even allowed to step foot on anyone's property if there's a ditch there. That's what's interesting about this. But yet, if I see where someone's walked...
We're kind of getting into discussion among the committee, and I have one other person who's signed up to testify that I'd like to call. Unless, Representative Cowan, was your question of Mr. Landauer? Anyone else have a question of Mr. Landauer? Then let's call Jim Welsh up, please, with the Oregon Cattlemen. Okay. Please.
Chair Nolan, Jim Welsh with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. We came in support of this, and with a little reference to some history, back in 1995 we started with this kind of concept of access on private property, and we worked through a number of iterations of this before we finally came down with something that you see in statute today. And we were trying to, at that time, there was a lot of requests for use of private property to access, of course, federal property or state lands, public property, or to access the private property for wood cutting. And at that time, it was, and still is, very important to individuals to cut wood and on certain property which is not theirs, and to leave. And also we expanded to recreation. And we just had a hearing this morning in natural resources and agriculture talking about the landowner preference program. And of course that's access to private property for recreation. And so this could apply. I'm no attorney, but I realize that anything can be interpreted and taken into court. And so what you can do on your property and what you can't do on your property certainly is going to be discussed by attorneys and can be used against you. But it was always the premise and the intent, clear back in 95, that the things that we did, if we did not do things that were going to cause harm, that we would have a certain protection, and that's what we were looking for. We wanted people to access our property where they we knew probably that fairly well that they were going to do the things on the property that they were intended to do, that they would be safe, and we wouldn't put anything in their path that was going to cause a problem. So we support that intent, and after reading this particular bill and as it broadens what we had in present law, we could be supportive of that. We know what the districts are trying to do, but for public or for private property, we feel that it could be something we can continue to support. So,
okay. Any questions for Mr. Walsh? Do you have an opinion about the Dash 3 amendment?
You know, I haven't seen that.
Or Dash 2?
I haven't seen 1, 2, or 3. So.
Okay. Great. Thanks. Thank you. Any further discussion? We're in public hearing on this bill. We do not have the necessary documentation to move the bill today, so we will not be going to work session today. But I would like to get a sense of the committee on your interests. Representative Cowan?
Could we get clarity? Have we already talked about the Dash 1s and I'm just forgetting it? Or
no, we didn't.
The Landauer, are the Dash 1s yours?
The Dash 1s are contained in the Dash 3s, so
okay.
They're no longer necessary.
Okay.
Oh,
thank
I'm
you.
Sorry. I missed that, I guess. Okay.
Representative Cowan, anything more?
I guess if they were incorporated in his explanation, I just didn't read them that way, but I'll try to read more carefully.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrett pointed out that on the sheet here, that what's described as the Dash 2 is actually the Dash 3.
In the summary?
In the summary.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, just because there was some confusion, we didn't have...
Probably written before we knew
right,
that the Dash 2 existed.
Right, but the Dash 2, as it's posted, is actually the Dash 3.
Okay. All right.
Madam Chair.
Is that correct?
It would have to be a typo on
yes,
my part.
Yes, because you wrote up the staff summary and you didn't have the Dash 2.
The Dash 2s came today.
Okay, so yes. That's correct. Representative Garrett?
Actually, I think Representative Wingard was next.
Oh.
I just wondered if it was the chair's intention to combine, to entertain the Dash 2s at all, and if so, I assume they need to be combined with the 3s.
We can move both of them if it's the committee's interest, and then LC has to figure out how to do that. They do it all the time. I am only now aware of the Dash 2, so I don't have an intention. I'm surveying the committee as to level of interest. So far, I'm getting a really high level of interest
well,
reading.
I don't have any problem with the Dash 2s, adding the word gardening in.
Yeah.
I have no idea if there are implications behind that, so I want to check on that first. But thank you for that. How about the Dash? Representative Hanna?
No problem with the gardening on my part.
Representative, what about the underlying bill?
Frankly, it's a bit perplexing.
You stumped us all.
I've not seen that type of common law discussed. I have a bit of Representative Wingard's curiosity with it. It does seem a bit odd. I think given that the cattlemen and others must have had legal counsel examine it, must understand where they're going, or they wouldn't be in here talking about it. They have certainly... I would suppose both from the districts and cattlemen's significant land parcels that would have exactly what they're talking about. So I can't imagine they'd be here if they didn't both legally and from a practical standpoint understand where they're going.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Garrett.
This is why the first year of law school is not known for being terribly fun, but... as bizarre as the common law rule may seem to people, I would note that the Dash 2 amendments would be an improvement upon it because we are expanding an immunity that's not currently there. So for people who don't like the common law, I don't think that would be a good reason not to support the Dash 2.
You mean the 3?
Yes, I mean the Dash 3. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, I would just, as long as you're taking a poll, I understand the point that you and Representative Garrett have made. And to some degree, I agree with it. I mean, I see the logic behind it. I'll support the bill, but I am still concerned with the same thing that you expressed the concern about. But I think that what the net effect of these, of the common law ruling or what have you, of this type of legislation is that it will discourage people from making improvements on their land that they might have done. And that just remains a concern of mine, that we really haven't created an incentive for people to do that.
Representative Callan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually am quite supportive of this bill and the dash threes, and I don't particularly have a problem with the way common law works. I understand if you're trying to be nice and make it a little easier, why aren't you rewarded for that? But this idea of access to private land for recreational use and how do you get there is something that actually comes up quite frequently. It certainly does in my area, and I'm not talking about oceanfront as much as I am opportunities to get into the woodlands and how to go there. And I'm trying to avoid the need for closing gates and closing off access to areas where people are allowed to recreate. It would be, I think, really unfortunate if places like irrigation district or entities like irrigation districts were forced to shut off that access because of inane law, with no offense, but I don't understand exactly how to get there in legal language, but I'm trusting that this is accomplishing that. When I look at the dash twos, I'm not sure that the writing of those, that was done with an understanding of the purpose of this piece of legislation, which is access, and they more address activities on the land that's accessed. So somebody with a better legal mind than I would have to help figure out whether that was appropriate or not, I think. I understand the relating clause. I'm just a little concerned about the ultimate goals.
Here's what I think might make sense. That we bring this bill back for a work session. If we can make the dash two amendment work, I see that it's got a blank in it. We'll try to do that. If we can't, we might just send it to the Senate and encourage Senator Starr to fix it over there. I mean, if we can make it work quickly within the next week, I'm not hearing any opposition to trying to accommodate gardening.
I do a little, because I think the two purposes, one is for access and the other is for use of the land one is accessing. And that to me is conflicting.
Okay. Since I'm counting, maybe you and Representative Garrett want to work on this together. I think it'll take 20 minutes. Yes. Representative Greenlet?
In terms of the general comments on the bill, I was wondering the extent to which this is similar to the adverse possession law and the question of posting and not posting and whether what we're trying to do here is to maintain the private right to keep people off the land if you want to, at the same time making it available under some circumstances for people to be on the land. And I suspect it's of interest to Eastern Oregon because of hunting and a variety of other issues that are involved in it. So, I wonder if our legal colleague over there could, is there any nexus between these issues? Is that what's going on?
I don't think there is much nexus between the dash three and the dash two.
No. I was talking about the bill itself.
Oh, okay.
You were asking about general support for the bill itself, and that's what has me. Had me wondering about if it's sort of...
Let's just give it a go. Representative Garrett, see if you can bring us back an amendment that the committee is comfortable with.
We'll do.
Madam Chair, may I ask Representative Garrett a question? If described what Representative Greenlick just said, would you not go away from a public access into a private access if you limited the people?
I'm not sure I'm following your question.
Well, what he was talking about is that they allow a certain number of people through there, or at certain times he was referring to hunting. But wouldn't that be a private access instead of a public access? Because a public access is for anyone, correct? So wouldn't you change the nature of the whole thing at that point? Then it would be a permission basis and your liability would be only for private people.
The kind of situation we're worried about here, I think, is where
it's all public,
is where your land is being used with your knowledge for the public at large, not just for people who you invite, but for public access generally.
Let's remember that we're starting with current law, and so we're not debating current law. We're debating whether we can improve it incrementally for a few circumstances and not take on the underlying law.
Right.
If we can do that, let's try to do it. So let's, do we have this scheduled for work session again? Let's carry it over in work session to the next, and just keep it there. Anybody else? Comments, suggestions, volunteers? Don't all of you? It's okay.
I'm happy to try to help, but my feedback,
seriously, I think it's
mine doesn't get around the legalities of it.
Okay. We will do that. We'll carry it over. And I just got a note from the sponsor of the next bill that he would like to, well, we've got a public hearing on that. And do we have people signed up to testify on 2485, Mr. Hoyt? Oh, sorry. Let's close the public hearing on 2879. Thank you. The sponsor of this bill is still working on it and would like to carry it over, but I'd like to take testimony from people who showed up to testify. So let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2485. And I'd like to bring Mayor Janet Taylor and someone else from the City of Salem. And Linda, would you like to join them, or Ms. Ludwig, Linda Ludwig will join them.
We brought a visual aid.
Thank you very much.
That always helps me.
Thank you.
Well, Chair Nolan and committee, I am Salem Mayor Janet Taylor and appreciate the opportunity to give some testimony today. It's always fun to be on the other side of this.
Welcome, Madam
Thank
Mayor.
You. Thank you very much.
Nice to have you.
Thank you very much. Well, what our visual aid is shows you the urban growth boundary of Salem and Kaiser. We share an urban growth boundary. Kaiser is an incorporated city, so it is not, of course, in our city limits. What we're dealing with is when the annexation laws continue to change. It's getting so complicated to do annexations anymore. And you know, our state land use laws put these urban growth boundaries around to encourage the development within the urban growth boundaries. And yet our city limits doesn't go clear out to the urban growth boundaries. So as there is land needed for development, or if someone has a large lot and wants to have city water and sewer, annexation is the way that they obtain those services. We do all of our master planning to accommodate growth clear out to our urban growth boundary. So that means the water lines that, say, for instance, in West Salem, that come out this way are sized big enough to handle the development clear out to the urban growth boundary. So those in the city limits are paying for future growth. So we hope to be able, of course, to eventually annex property. What 2485 does is it takes things another step. In 2007, the legislature passed House Bill 3303, which allowed a person owning property that wasn't in its city limits to vote on the annexation. Prior to that, it was just people in the city limits. We supported that because I think you should have a vote about what's going to happen with your property. But what happens is 2485 takes it another step. It says someone who has property that's an enclave surrounded by the city can vote, and there has to be a majority vote for it in addition to a majority in the city limits. So that means somebody, say one individual who owned over 20 acres and didn't want to be annexed, could kill it totally. And so they would enjoy having access to city parks, the library and everything, but not pay city property taxes. What that does, that puts the burden on the rest of the city to carry the services that those that are not in the city enjoy. And we feel that's not what the state land use laws intended. They intended that if you were surrounded or inside that urban growth boundary, you would eventually help to support police and fire and library and parks and streets and streetlights and all of those amenities. So we're just feeling that since 2000, Salem has had voter-approved annexations, so we do have to vote already. And we've had 130 annexations in that time period. 130, and only one has failed to pass voter annexation. So our community pretty much understands the reasoning behind the urban growth boundary and annexing into the city. Only 33 of those were enclaves, but they involved 300 acres. Four of them were over 20-acre parcels, so we could have literally ended up with a 20-acre parcel, you know, right in the middle of our city that would have failed under this new bill that's being proposed. And that is not good planning for services. We feel it really kind of circumvents that whole statewide planning role. So we really encourage you to stop this bill. It is so complicated already and expensive for our staff to prepare everything for annexations. We would like to see them stay where they are. We have a special issue here in Salem in that we have all of this area and all of this area that are outside the city limits. And the way the laws are now, we can't really even get those annexed. So we just got a real issue already with annexation laws. And we just think it needs to stop at this point and let's relook at annexation and find a way to make it fair to those inside the city limits and those who are inside the urban growth boundary but not in the city limits yet. So, did you want to use my wonderful visual aid?
Thank you.
Why don't I move over and let you sit? It's a little easier, and I'll trade you with holding the...
I think you've got some assistance.
Oh, look, there's another easel coming forward.
And if there were any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
We'll hear from the panel, okay. And then Madam Mayor.
Okay.
Yes.
Chair Nolan, committee members, my name is Vicki Harden Woods, and I'm the easel and the community development director for the City of Salem. And thank you very much for having us here today. I brought this map because I wanted to show the committee the kinds of island annexations that we've had in Salem. I wanted to be able to demonstrate that they are not far-reaching, trying to grab land that's out on the edges of property, but they are actually holes in the fabric of our community. What you see on this map, the yellow and the red are annexations that have occurred, enclave or island annexations that have occurred since 2006. And the annexation laws and regulations are very complicated. And I've dealt with 130 voter annexations in the past nine years or so, and I can tell you that it's very difficult to explain to the public how annexation works and who's eligible for annexation, who isn't, what the rules and the regulations are. And we work very hard to try to give good, solid information to voters when they're making decisions about annexations, but the regulations are such that that's difficult to do, and the risk of putting something on the ballot, and I can tell you that we have had some major errors on occasion when it comes to getting something on the ballot, following all the procedures and the different kinds of rules and regulations that overlay annexations. Some of that is our own problem in our own local legislation, but much of it is also part of state law, that if we make an error and a vote is invalidated, we find that to be a huge injustice and work very hard not to have it happen. It hasn't happened yet, but we do feel that there's a great risk for that, and whenever there's a complicating factor and it gets a little more complicated to pursue annexations, that gets more and more difficult. You know, better to have clean and precise laws than to have a lot of complicated and competing laws. And the other thing that puts us in a difficult position, and I would point point out that to make an annexation over 20 acres that is an island more difficult than an annexation under 20 acres flies in the face of good planning, because actually the larger the hole we have in the fabric of our community, the more difficult it is for us to deliver efficient services. We are required by state law and the statewide planning goals to provide orderly and efficient public facilities to accommodate growth into the future. Goal 11, 12, and 14 all speak to that, and we implement that locally with our local legislation, which has criteria when we evaluate urban annexations, that the boundary results in services being provided in an orderly, efficient, and timely manner. That's hard to do when we have holes in the middle of our community. So I just wanted to bring you some information. I wanted to be available, I'll bet we have more experience than any other city in the state as far as dealing with voter annexations, and wanted to be available to answer questions.
Thank you. Ms. Ludwig?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Linda Ludwig with the League of Oregon Cities.
Pop that up right in front. Yeah.
We may have been a little bit remiss in not giving a little bit of an overview about what the bill actually does and how it sits in sort of the whole tiers of annexations. This bill deals with, deals with cities that have charter provisions that require an election for all annexations. So it is limited to those cities, and there are about 30 cities in the state of 242 that have those charter requirements. All types of methodologies of annexations have to go to a vote. This bill is further limited to island annexations, which are in statute in 222.750. And island annexations is one of a variety of maybe six or seven other types of annexation methodologies that cities utilize to bring territory into their incorporated boundaries. There are really three major points that I'd like to bring before you when we look at this bill. There was significant legislation that was passed last session in the 2007 session that dealt with island annexations. And I will say these have been the most politically volatile in sessions prior to 2007. So we've heard a lot about island annexations. In the 2007 legislation, four cities with charter requirements, they were required to allow the voters in the island that was proposed to be annexed to vote with the city, with the voters of the city limits. City charters could not compel folks to vote outside their city limits, so it took a piece of legislation that was passed last session to be able to enable those people in the islands to be able to vote. Representative Clem brought that piece of legislation forward. Also, for all cities, the use of island annexation was narrowed considerably in 2007. The use of the right-of-way or a roadway to create an island's perimeter was severely narrowed to 25% of that perimeter boundary. It narrowed the waterway definition that could be used as an island boundary. And it also, very important, I think, to some legislators and some concerns about the fairness of the island annexation methodology, it now requires for all cities that utilize this a 3-year delayed effective date for all properties that are zoned for residential use and in residential use, that are zoned residential and in residential use. So those property owners have the ability, once they are brought in to the island annexation, if they are residential property owners, they will have 3 years before that effective date occurs, which means their taxes will have, they will have a 3-year window of time before they may see tax increases. So that piece of legislation was put in 2003. We haven't yet really seen the results of whether or not that was very effective. Those pieces of legislation, along with another bill, 3013, that prohibited any type of annexation when incorporation proceedings were part of a package that was negotiated and spent most of the session with many legislative members. And we think it was a good package. So we have that in terms of our foundation. A couple other points that I'd like to bring forward, just in terms of the whole annexation debate. We believe that there are very valid policy reasons and legal reasons the courts have affirmed in Oregon, all levels of courts, LUBA, Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, and the Ninth Circuit, for the utilization of what we call island annexation or annexing enclaves. And most other states, I believe most other, if all, not all other states, allow that type of annexation mostly with unilateral approval, being that they do not require voters to vote on an enclave annexation. And the reason that these enclaves occur is often, especially if you have a city that will only annex if a property owner consents, as you get annexations that come along, sometimes those requesting property owners inadvertently create a pocket or an enclave, an island in the fabric of the city that aren't in the incorporated areas. And the reason that you heard from the good representatives of Salem, it creates service inefficiencies in terms of the provision of services, especially when you have cities providing those services. And in the majority of the state, although it may not be true in Washington County or particularly Clackamas County, most cities actually do provide services within the state.
Okay.
So I've given you some material there. There's more background material than you probably ever want to know about annexations, and I can be a resource with that. But the most important point I would like to make in terms of annexation policy and the debate that we've had over the years here is I believe there absolutely is a need to match the objectives of our land use planning program with our annexation policies, and that has not occurred yet. We are slowly, I think, making progress. I would hope to believe progress in that direction. You have seen as an amendment into House Bill 229 a concept that we also saw in the Washington County, brought forward in the Washington County Urbanization Forums, that would match movement of the urban growth boundary with issues and decisions of governance. And those concepts that have been brought forward is waiting to move the urban growth boundary until a city would approve eventual annexation and make some decisions about the provision of services. I think this debate needs to move forward in those quarters, and I'm concerned that if we nip at individual annexation methodologies, that we will lose the focus in actually trying to better marry our land use planning process that came much later than our annexation methodologies in terms of really be able to provide good urbanization policies throughout the state.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Just a minute, Representative. For the record, I also thank you to the panel, and then I'll open it up for questions. I just want to make sure we acknowledge that we have received written testimony from Barton Ryerly on behalf of the City of Newburgh as well, and that will be part of our record. Representative Greenlick,
yes,
questions,
ma'am,
for the panel.
Yeah, I'd like to preface my question with a brief statement. In the 2003, 2005, 2007 session, we dealt with annexation as an issue, and we dealt with it not only as a land use issue, but as a question of popular democracy. The very simple notion we had is that people have a right to choose, or at least to vote, on the nature of the government that governs them. And the modifications we made to ORS 195, which is the basic annexation statute, was to assure that people who were to be annexed had a chance to vote on that annexation. And the vote had a chance to count, not 50,000 residents against 50 residents. And you add them together and you get 50,000 and 50, and all 50 vote no, but half of the others vote yes, and we're in a new, we have a new governance structure. Now, the exception to those kinds of things were to the 222750 statute, which had to do with island annexations, with the notion that there would be small pockets inside cities that would end up not being annexed, and the notion if you're sitting in the middle of an area and you have a small pocket.
We're not yet in work session.
I know,
but
the question's
coming.
I'd
like to get to the question so that we can focus on the on holding a public hearing, and if we may not even get to work session on the bill. So
I know.
I would appreciate it if we focus on questions.
Okay. I need to finish my statement, and then I can ask the question because it frames the question. And if you'll forgive me just a little moment more, I don't take much of the time in this committee, and I would appreciate that. The basic notion of island annexation was that there would be little tiny places. And I would like to ask, what triggered, in terms of Salem, the notion, how big of the areas within the fabric, not on the edge, not contiguous, but surrounded, what triggered this kind of a reaction to say if you have more than 20 acres in the middle, that's a pretty big piece, then you have that same ORS 195 right to be voting. Were there significant issues that were that large in this? Have you annexed areas bigger than 20 acres?
Yeah, four of them. We have annexed in the last, since 2006, the majority of our Representative Nolan members of the committee, we have annexed four separate enclave annexations that were over 20 acres in size. They did not raise especially larger problems from the perspective, I think, of the people who live or own the property than the smaller ones. I'm not sure what has motivated a provision to be presented to you that says that if it's over 20 acres, those people should have a right to vote and those people under 20 acres should not. In fact, have a right to have a majority vote count. From the city's perspective, it would be almost the opposite that you'd want to see, because the larger the whole, the bigger the problem is. So we have not experienced extra problems with those areas as far as resistance from property owners. Obviously, the larger the whole, the more difficult it is for us to go around it when we have to provide services. Did that answer your question?
It's kind of tough to ask people who are testifying against the bill why the bill is being brought forward.
I was just wondering how big those, I mean, were they really big or were they like 21 acres?
No, they were very close to 28, just a little over.
Thank you.
Good question. Anything else? Other questions for the panel?
Madam Chair.
Representative Esquivel.
So you currently, on your island annexations, you have to go through a voting process because you put that out for vote in 2001 and the people said, yeah, let's do that, and so on and so forth. You know, we have, and this astounded me because the city I came from, we do application annex where people ask to come into the city, and we really don't experience much of these problems, except occasionally you will get an island in the middle. Mm-hmm. What do you do at that point? You still have to go through the process, and if they say no, the way this is set up, they're the ones that can block the whole thing. You could have, theoretically, a piece in the middle of the city that could be 25 acres or something of that nature. I can understand the problem. Okay. And yet they use your infrastructure, they use your roads, now parks and stuff like that. But now, do you allow people that are not annexed into the city, you don't allow them water and sewage, do you?
Many years ago, before I was in office, probably 25 or more, the two areas on the right-hand side of our boundary, the one to the north, Jan Ray, the city purchased the water sewer system and converted it into city water and sewer. So
they do have city water and sewer. East Salem, they were also allowed to contract to have city water and sewer. So both of those areas that are not in the city limits do have city water and sewer. We are not responsible for police or fire or the streets, sidewalks, any of that. But what we're experiencing is that, as you can see, we're getting built out. And in the more southern piece that isn't in the city limits, there's a 100-acre parcel there that is flat land with nothing on it. They want to annex. A school wants to, the school district wants to build a school there. But the way things set, we can't really annex them. And so it's a real, annexation is a difficult problem for Salem.
Follow up, Madam Chair. I'm
not following why you can't annex them.
Okay, I'll let the lady who has to make
it work. Is it because it isn't contiguous to the city limits?
Right, and there's so many parcels, so
it's in those white areas in the south.
Gotcha. Yeah.
This is the parcel in particular that the mayor is referring to, and I think the reference is to the fact that we can only annex that at the petition or the application of a landowner, and there's a willing landowner in this case, and if it's approved by the voters. So, which I think is what how the law was changed back in 01 or 02 when that happened. And so because we have local voter annexation, that applicant comes in, applies for annexation, we put it through the process, it goes on the ballot. So far, all but one of those have been approved, but we could be thwarted in being able to annex that property by the voters.
By the existing voter.
Mm-hmm. You could. And in one case, the existing voters said they didn't approve.
Yes, yes. In one case, it was turned down.
Yes. Anything else? Other questions? Anyone else here to testify?
Thank you. Thank you for your service. I know.
Thank you very much.
I know what it's like.
And you as well.
I could speak to it. It was my bill, but I didn't think we were going to go forward because the speaker couldn't come down, so that's my fault. I obviously introduced the bill. In some states, they have things like this, but the acreages are usually larger. We have a long-standing issue. The mayor and I think have some good ideas on how to potentially resolve it. A lot of them involve charter amendments, though not state law, to help distinguish between people who actually voluntarily want to be annexed, who are all out on the ballot, even if it's a quarter acre, and that's unnecessary, but that's in our charter. I helped put it there, so that's my contribution, but I'm helping to get it out at some point when it's a voluntary annexation of a small size. And then the question for me is just about large parcels, especially if they're involuntary. And so that's sort of the offering behind the bill. But we got lots of conversations to have yet before my city and I get anywhere close on that. So thank you for hearing the bill.
You bet. Thank you. Thank you. We're going to close that public hearing. Colleagues, before I adjourn the committee for today, a little bit of heads up. We are coming into the finish, approaching the finish line for action on House bills, and we've got several House bills that are significant that we still want to work. I believe we have House Bill 2229 scheduled next Tuesday.
We've not yet posted. Okay. I'm not sure. We're waiting for the deadline.
We are intending to post that for work session. We have tried to, Representative Garrett has done yeoman's work trying to assemble all the ideas that seem to have significant support on that bill. What we will do is bring you, as soon as we have an LC drafting of those ideas, get that to you. Time permitting, it's my intention that we would have a work session on the amendment and then move the amendment and the bill in a subsequent work session. But I am mindful that we are all running out of time on action on House bills. So it's our hope that we will be able to do that, and in any case, we will stay in touch with you.
and continue to solicit your input on House Bill 2229, which is the implementation of recommendations from the Big Look Task Force. We also continue to have work on two other significant bills before this committee, namely House Bill 3099, which is relating to exclusive farm use, and recommendations that came out of interim work on removing some of the exemptions there in order to protect farmland for farm use. And then House Bill 3100, which would accept the nomination of the Land Conservation and Development Commission to name the Metolius an area of the Metolius Basin as an area of statewide critical concern. And we have at least one other bill. One other bill. House Bill 3225, the bill on Measure 49 claims. We will. Do we have word on? We don't have word on the Senate bill yet.
If 945.
If Senate Bill 945 goes to their floor and crosses the Senate floor, it is our understanding that that bill would then be referred to us, and we would work that bill. But we have House Bill 3225, which we heard the other day. If we don't get Senate Bill 945, it would be my intention to work House Bill 3225 to address the issues of Measure 49 claims. So one way or the other, we will either take action on House Bill 3225 or on Senate Bill 945. Senate Bill 945 has a later deadline for action, so we might not do that before. And then the bill we heard and worked today on the access question. Yes.
We have three more sessions, right, that we can do House bills?
Yes, we have next Tuesday, next Thursday, and the following Tuesday. Yes, and that's the end of action on House bills.
And all those things need to be posted for work session
by tomorrow.
Right.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. So you'll probably see all active bills being posted, just so that we retain flexibility. That means this is final call for any bills to be worked that are House bills. So if you I have heard from a few of you, and we've had some consultations about that, heard a couple bills. We have one other posted for hearing. Let me know if you'd like anything else on our agenda. So we're adjourned.
You're much more efficient.